Welcome, everyone, to episode 299 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and now that the dust from the trade deadline has settled, we are going to check in on how the biggest acquisitions are faring in their new homes. Before we get to that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. And we're now being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today, as always, is my very stable genius of a co-host, Morten Jensen. How's it going, Mort?
It's going well, Brian. I actually have a newfound respect for Dallas Mavericks fans because I'm on Basketball Reference and on the trending player pages. That was apparently very hard to say. Michael Kidd Gilchrist's name is popping up. That has to be the last time in the history of his career that he's ever going to be trending unless he does something absolutely fantastic. So good on MKG for getting his shine.
Yeah, there you go. His 15 minutes of fame are just about up, but he's getting one more chance. The featured, that's amazing.
Wow. I love that. I really hope for him that he actually, you know, resurrects, I want to say, his career. That might be unfair, but look, it's just not gone well, right?
No.
He needs something new. Maybe that's playing with Luka and just being this, you know, kind of slashing power forward, I guess.
Yeah.
Just one rule in Dallas, like, don't ever take threes.
right. Never shoot. Just rebound, play good defense, and you can do offensive putbacks. That's about it.
Yeah, that's good. Like, at 5 feet and in, just stay with it that way and just rebound your ass off and become like an old school, you know, old Sean Marion kind of
player. Right. All right, let's go into... I want to start with the Houston Rockets because I think it's fair to say that, you know, in terms of how these teams are structured, no team underwent a change as seismic as what the Houston Rockets did, sending out Clint Capella to the Atlanta Hawks, bringing in Robert Covington, which means they don't have a starting center above 6'5". It is the 6'5", P.J. Tucker is their starting center. Robert Covington at 6'7", is one of their tallest, if not the tallest, rotation player. They have just completely doubled down on small ball, which I wrote a thing at Fansided this week and kind of said, like, this is the end game of Morey Ball. Like, this is the logical extension. And this is exactly, like, they're just saying, you know what? We're going to get killed on the glass. We're going to get killed in terms of offense, rebound, putbacks. We're going to have no rim protection like other teams do. We don't care. We're going to outgun you, outrun you, run you off the floor. And so far, I mean, the game after the trade deadline, they beat the Lakers 121-111. The next night, Russ doesn't play. The Phoenix Suns blow him out by 36. They lost to the Utah Jazz by 1 in a game where Bojan Bogdanović hit probably one of the best game-winning shots you'll see this year with 1.6 seconds left on the shot clock. They played great defense. It was just a hell of a shot. Can't be bad about that. And then last night against Boston, they win by 11. So, Mort, how would you grade the Rockets' small ball experiment through the first few games?
Well, because it's such a small sample size, I mean, it's impossible to really give them a solidified grade, but I guess a solid B-plus so far, you know, considering this sheer amount of doubt that I had and people had coming in. I think, you know, they're one Bojan Bogdanović crazy ass shot away from being 3-1.
Yeah, against three good teams.
Against three good teams, and that matters. So, you know, a B plus right now, that doesn't mean that my concerns are gone and dead or buried. I think Russell Westbrook has played phenomenally in recent months, to be honest with you.
Yes.
Which I did not anticipate saying.
Yes. I was just waiting for you to say that because, you know, early this season, I took my Russ victory lap thinking it might be short-lived. And for a while it was, but he has come back with a vengeance. And I think the thing that always drove you and a lot of people nuts was that he just bailed teams out, bailed opponents out by taking, like, jacking up dumb threes, like early in shot clock, early in transition threes. He's not a good three-point shooter. He has never been a good three-point shooter. like, he is so hyper athletic and can get to the rim whenever he wants that, like, that's what you want out of Russell Westbrook. Well, over the past 11 games, he has attempted 16 threes in total. Mm-hmm. He's only hit 4 of them, which is about in line with his career rate, which is what you would expect. But he's averaging almost 35 points, 9 rebounds, 7 assists, shooting 54% from the field, basically. He's drawing 7 free throw attempts per game. His free throw percentage has bounced up to 80 in that time. I mean, this is the good Russ. This is the, like, the longest stretch of good Russ that we've seen in a while.
And another very, very crucial point here. In terms of his shot selection, mm-hmm. he is taking the vast majority of his shots within 10 feet.
Yeah.
And that is crucial for a guy like him. Like, granted, this is the typical Russ experiment. Like, he is still shooting 15.5% of his shots from the 16 feet out to the three-point line. Mm-hmm. Like, that shot has not gone away.
Sure.
And it's even higher than last year.
Yeah.
Which is good. Like, really? On the Houston, no less?
Yeah.
But he's just made up for it by just getting to the rim a lot more, which was always the solution for Russ, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who was it on Twitter? I don't know if you've seen it. I don't remember who wrote it. I was scrolling, and I saw it, and I chuckled, and I kind of agreed with it, and then I scrolled on further. But someone said, basically, Russell Westbrook is being used like Amari Stoudemire, just as a point guard.
Oh, I didn't see that. I saw a mini Giannis comp from...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't remember who had that, but...
I'm not on that one, but I do like the Amari comparison.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, because, you know, D'Antoni is there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not wrong. Like, he's not being used in terms of, like, you know, big man sets the screen and then you have Steve Nash feeding him. But there is this element of just... You know, sheer volatile craziness, athleticism, and you know, this relentless ability to attack the basket, which mm-hmm. is very Stoudemire like. And then you have Harden, who's taking like a little bit of a step back, I want to say,
mm-hmm.
just to allow Russ to be more of a scorer. Like, Harden's numbers have gone down just a little bit, but that's by design, it yeah. seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I like, you know, I like you, I have concerns about. Do I think this is going to necessarily win them a championship? Probably not, but I think they're at least have a better shot now than they did prior to the trade deadline. Like, I thought they had no chance as previously constructed to win a title this year. Now I think, you know, it would take a number of circumstances to unfold, but I think they increased their variance significantly by,
right.
you know, just doubling down on this strategy. I mean, basically... When they traded for Russ this summer, they forced their hand here. Because Russ is such a bad shooter, and we saw early in the year that teams were doubling Harden like out to the half-court line and just right. saying, like, all right, we'll play 4-on-3 with the rest of your team. And that includes Russell Westbrook, who we know can get to the rim because Clint Capella is such a non-threat from beyond the arc that we're not worried. We can still clog the paint and dare Russ to either shoot or pass and hope your other guys miss. So by getting rid of Capella, now you can't play that strategy. Like, now you have 4 shooters around Russ, where if you're playing 4-on-3, it's not going to work as well. So I give credit to Daryl Morey here, just realizing, like, you know, we need to build around James and Russ, and we need to maximize their skill set. And if it means taking Clint Capella off of the floor entirely... And, you know, having a 6'5 center, that's okay because that guy could shoot and that's going to space the floor more for Russ. And Russ is going to be able to get to the rim far more easily and far more often. And that's when we're going to see our best version of Russ. So, like, I admire Morey's moxie here to just say, you know what, this is the best way we can maximize our two guys. And I think it's smart for teams to, like, look at their... players' individual skill sets, their star players' individual skill sets, and say, all right, here's what we need to do, even if it sounds absolutely crazy. Starting a 6'5 center sounds crazy, but this is the way we get the most out of these guys.
Well, is it even more crazy than looking at Jimmy Butler and going, you know who we need to pair with Jimmy Butler? Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade.
3 alphas, man.
No, but you're right. And I think there's something else to this equation that I think is interesting. I haven't looked at these numbers, admittedly, at whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Like, this is just a thought that hit me. You know how we mentioned the lack of, or the potential lack of rebounding by losing Capella?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Russ averaged 11 rebounds last year. Most of that is, you know, compared to normal standards, were kind of deferred. Like, that was, like, Steven Adams and, right, and guys boxing out, letting Russ grab those. But he did grab them, and he has been a very, very good rebounder for his entire career.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's an element of that going into this you know, belief that, you know, maybe we aren't going to get pounded on the glass so much. Like, Harden is a good rebounder. He had a year where he averaged 8. You know, Russ is averaging 8 right now, and he has a history of being able to, you know, at least crash the glass.
Right.
Maybe not, you know, maybe the numbers in Oklahoma City were inflated, but he's sure as hell not a bad rebounder. So maybe we can live off of that. And then as soon as he gets one of those defensive boards, like, beep, beep, it's like he's crossed half court,
right,
you know, within a second.
Right.
It's intriguing. I don't know if this will carry over to the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest concern for me. Because right, when the intensity shifts and when every possession is being slowed down, like, Houston is going to try to push the pace.
Yeah,
for sure. But if they match up against, like, you know, the Clippers or the Jazz, like, great defensive teams, I don't know whether or not they're going to have great success of keep pushing the tempo. I think those teams will dictate a lot of what's going to happen on the floor.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are still questions up in the air, but so far it's fun, at least.
Right? Like, ultimately, that's where I land. I'm enjoying these Rockets. I'm enjoying watching these Rockets more than I have for the past, like, 3 or 4 years. And I said that last night and caught a little bit of heat for it, which I was just surprised by. Like, people accused me of being a Rockets fan. Like, no, I've actively not enjoyed watching this team. It was, I mean,
oh, come clean, Brian. They have Robert Covington. Of course you're a Houston fan.
That's true. That does swing me. And I love Russ. You know me.
Yeah, for sure. And Harden is your favorite player by far. I know that.
Okay, now we're stretching it. Yeah.
I know that you find him more aesthetically pleasing than everyone in history.
Right? I mean, look, I hate the foul baiting as much as anyone, but I think, like, the fact that they're going in on such a drastically different style it's just fun to watch. It's fun to see Robert Covington and PJ Tucker defending like their hair is on fire. It's fun to see their switch everything scheme. You know, right, would I like to see them not try to bait as many fouls? Of course. You know, am I mad that they're going to shoot 45 to 53s a game? God, no. Like, that's smart. They are just banking on math, right? They're banking on saying, you know, yes, we missed 27 threes in a row against the Warriors, and if we didn't, we're probably the NBA champions 2 years ago. At some point, like, we're just going to bury you. We are going to outshoot you, and you can beat us on the glass. I mean, it's been a mixed bag in that department so far. They kept it close against the Lakers. I think it was 38-37. The Suns game, I think you almost have to throw out just because Russ wasn't playing, and, you know, they got killed everywhere. They got killed in the paint. Right. They got killed in the glass. They got killed. Even three-point shooting, they lost. Boston last night, Boston out-rebounded them 48-45. So, again, pretty close. Utah was 48-36. So, I mean, again, not a surprise. Rudy Gobert pulled in 15 on his own. Look, they are going to get killed more often than not in any interior category. Pick, you know, points in the paint, rebounds, block shots, whatever. But it's, you know, it's going back to Maury's, like, where are the most expected points per possession? Post-ups we have proven, you know, repeatedly that post-ups for most guys are not efficient shots. They're, in fact,
right,
some of the least efficient shots in basketball. You do not want to be posting up Clint Capella. Okay, so if we're not posting up Clint Capella, let's take him off the floor for PJ Tucker, who's going to space the floor, shoot threes, give more space to Russ and Harden to drive, and they're going to draw a ton of fouls. Great. Now we're maximizing our guys. I love it.
Well, I agree with you, but there is one concern from my perspective. And mm-hmm. while you are, you know, they obviously lead the league in most threes, both made and attempted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're only 22nd in percentage.
Yeah.
And that's where you just alluded to it. Like, there's a lot of swing there.
Right? Oh, yeah.
That you can absolutely lose a game off of that.
Yeah.
You know, if they were more middle of the pack instead of being that low in the league ranking, I would probably feel just a little bit more secure, because it doesn't feel like they have that one truly knockdown shooter. I'm just looking over their stats right now. They actually don't have a single player hitting over 40% from deep.
Yeah, right. They have a, I mean, McLemore can get hot. Daniel House can get hot. Tucker, Harden, Covington, Rivers, Eric Gordon. They can all get hot at some point, but they are all very streaky shooters.
Right. Right. There isn't a Kyle Korver there, is basically what I'm saying.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
And I wonder if that was one of the things they probably should have addressed at the trade deadline.
Yeah, I mean, then it just comes down to, is Tillman Fertitta willing to pay the tax? And I think we both know the answer to that one.
Yeah, that's a problem. I hope for their sake that someone steps up out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think Chris Clemens has a very, very good release, and I think there's some potential there. But wait a second. He wasn't waived, right? He's still there.
It looks like he's still there.
Who got waived? They waived someone right after the deadline. I'm totally blanking on who it is, but never mind. If he's still there, that's my point. Like, that's another guy who could potentially come in and maybe turn into that, you know, reliable shooter.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they're banking on volume, and good on them for at least trying that out, but you also need the efficiency. You can't have volume and live off of that alone. I mean, Allen Iverson is the major proof of that, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
All right, Mort, let's change gears, and we'll go into two teams that faced each other last night, the Los Angeles Clippers and the Philadelphia 76ers. Who do you want to start with?
Well, do I have a choice in the matter?
Yeah, we can start with either one.
No, let's get the Philly out of the way. Let's go for it. There's always more meat on the Clippers or on the Sixers, because you know you have Instagram posts and apparently Joel Embiid is about to get traded,
right?
Which is very impressive to me since the trade deadline just passed. It's all very interesting.
Yep, he is trying to force his way to Miami, and now WIP callers have turned against him and are calling him soft and saying they want to restart the process, which is actually something that happened. Go to my Twitter.
And then go do it with Elton Brand. That makes sense.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's going to go really well. No, we're not getting into any of that stupid stuff. If you cared, watch the TNT pregame show last night. They covered it in detail. The big storyline from last night's game is not Alec Burks, not Glenn Robinson. It's they bench Al Horford. This is a move that a lot of people, including myself, have been kind of hoping to see for a while now. Not necessarily because we think Al Horford is bad and useless and, you know, a waste of $109 million, but like, it just conceptually made sense that their offensive spacing got so clogged with Al, Ben, and Joe together. They were averaging 98.9 points per 100 possessions with those three guys, which is like five points worse than the Warriors, who have the league's worst offense.
Right.
Like,
it disgusting.
Right. It reached the point of, okay, we can stick with this stubbornly for the rest of the season and hope it turns around and then probably lose in the first round of the playoffs, or we can, you know, risk the ego hit to Horford, who, you know, Brett Brown said he handled it like a pro, but I'm sure he's pissed off right now. I have no doubt that he's, you know, he came out and said, like, this isn't the role I envisioned, but whatever, I'm doing what's best for the team, which is a mature response, at least publicly. But
to be fair, when has he not been pissed off ever since signing with this team?
Yeah, I mean, like, I honestly think, like, I mean, the Sixers won 110-103 last night, but more than the result of the game, they just looked better. And, like, all of their players, all of their core five guys suddenly had a good game together, I can't think of another game where all five guys played well. So, I mean, I don't know. Brett Brown after the game said, you know, he made the change in part because he thought the Clippers were going to go small, which was, you know, I don't know if that's his justification for making the change permanently or if it's just like a one-time thing and Al's going to move back into the starting lineup after the All-Star break. But this move makes sense, and I think the acquisitions of Alec Burks and Glenn Robinson at the trade deadline, as we mentioned, I think last episode, kind of unlocked this possibility, because now you suddenly have more wings and guards who can actually, like, Alec Burks can create off the dribble. He hit a shot off of a screen and roll in the first quarter last night, which is something the Sixers just didn't have outside of Josh Richardson, really. Glenn
and
Robinson,
that's all he hit.
Yeah, well, it was a valuable shot at the time. Glenn Robinson in the third quarter, like, scored a couple baskets off of cuts, which was great. And why did he have the space to do that? Because they didn't have four guys in the paint. Like, their spacing just looked so much better last night than it has for most of the season. That, you know, for their sake and for Al's sake, I hope he's willing to take this ego hit. I mean, Brett, after the game, mentioned Manu Ginobili as kind of like the quintessential example of, hey, you know, it's okay to come off the bench and, like, you're still going to play. He played 28 minutes last night. So did Embiid. I think part of that was foul trouble. Embiid got two fouls early in the game and had to sit through, I think, the rest of the first quarter. It's a change that I hope they carry on for, you know, they play the Nets coming out of the All-Star break. Then they go travel to Milwaukee as their first road game. And Lord knows, the Sixers have not been good on the road this season. I hope they stick with it at least for those two games, because I would be really curious to see if this increases their chance of beating Milwaukee.
Yeah. No, I like you said, more symmetry for sure. You know, in the playoffs, that's where it's going to be interesting, because rotations are going to shorten significantly. So there's going to be more overlap of positioning at that point.
Yep.
So this is going to be a process.
Yep.
You know, it is.
You're not wrong.
I'm still a little bit skeptical of the whole thing, because I still don't see Philly being, you know, a team that's going to generate natural spacing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes teams gets up and just finds a way to do something when a player is benched or after a trade. They just...
Sure.
Somehow, since things just go the right way, like the Minnesota Timberwolves right after the trade just tore through the Clippers.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, strange things happen.
Sure.
So I want to see this over the next couple of weeks before I really, like, build an opinion on it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I mean, it does allow just having freaking Korkmaz in there. I know he went scoreless and he didn't hit a damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter. He's proven enough this year. Well, it's not... Yeah, well, it will matter if he keeps, you know, throwing up eggs, but you know what I mean.
Right.
Like, he's such a target offensively that teams are just not going to leave him.
Yeah.
Whereas if you throw Al in there in that whole massacre of lack of spacing, it's just, you know, you're going to have four guys inside the 3-point line, and it's just not going to work. Like, yeah. I think I said this as well. Like after the trade deadline, you know, I was watching the Bucks Sixers game. And, like, it was so easy for Milwaukee to actually just guard this team. Like, they played at, like, 60% in the first quarter, even though Philly actually ended up leading.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't even assert any effort, because they just knew, oh, yeah, well, that the lack of spacing is going to, like, handcuff them, and they're going to stumble over their own feet.
Yeah. Like, you're daring, in that starting five, you are leaving Al wide open on the 3-point line and daring him to shoot, because he has just not been hitting open shots at the rate he usually does. And you know, is that because they're asking him to catch and shoot more, and, like, it's fewer pick and pops, or who knows? I that is the $109 million question for the Sixers. But you know, pushing him to the bench allows him to be more of the fulcrum of that second unit, which I think is great. I mean, separating him from both Embiid and Simmons, you know, Burks can create off the dribble for sure, but he's not, like, a natural point guard, so they can tap into Al's passing instincts more than they have. You know, in the starting lineup, the ball is going to flow through Ben, Joe, the Tobias to some extent. I mean, Jay Rich took over late last night, so, like, Al's just not going to get the touches that he's used to, whereas off the bench, like, I think this it just leads to a more logical rotation where, like, suddenly you're not going to have these 4-minute offensive droughts. And I think those are what, you know, against Boston, Miami, even Milwaukee, like, they played all of those teams relatively close in the first half, and then they come out in the third quarter, go scoreless for a couple minutes, and all three of those games turn into routes. I think that this change in the rotation, if it sticks, will potentially combat that. And to the Korkmaz point, like, I mean, he started the first half last night. The Clippers were actively hunting him on defense, Brett Brown moved Glenn Robinson into the starting lineup in the second half. I think that's the play moving forward. I've been saying it since the day of the deadline. Like, I think Robinson is not a weak link defensively. He's a lower usage player than Korkmaz, so he's not... I mean, Korkmaz took one of the most aggressive heat checks he has all season last night, which, God help him, I love him, but never again.
Which is impressive, considering heat checks are usually taken after you've hit a shot or two.
I know. Well, I mean, he's coming off 30-point, back-to-back 30-point games. He was trying to get the mojo going, but it was like, oh, God, it was so bad. But, you know, Robinson, I think, will just be like a low-usage 3 and D guy, which is great when you're playing next to three high-usage players in Joe, Ben, Tobias. And then, you know, Cork can come off the bench, be the microwave scorer. You got Al being the second unit facilitator. You got Burks off there out the dribble. You got Matisse coming in and just wrecking havoc on defense. Like, I've been saying since the deadline, like, the Sixers, I still think, have the pieces to figure this thing out. I did not think they were going to bench Al before the deadline, before the All-Star break. And I was like, I had 300 words of a should the Sixers bench Al Horford column written heading into last night's game. And then I saw that they were going to do it. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm staying up till 3 a.m. tonight to finish this stupid thing, which I did. I'm encouraged by the first result. I think it's important not to read too much into it because the Clippers front court is one of their weaknesses. I mean, the Sixers got kind of whatever they wanted down there all night. They destroyed them in terms of points in the paint and rebounds. So we'll see if this holds. I think the Milwaukee road game is going to be a really good test, good early test of this. But I'm encouraged by, I said it last night on Twitter, like, I can get behind this version of the Sixers. If regardless of what happens moving forward, if they stick with this plan, I go down with the ship. But like, hey, at least you tried something.
Right. No, I agree.
So let's go to the Clippers side of things then, because Marcus Morris played, I believe, his second game as a Clipper. Yeah. Naturally got in his first fight as a Clipper. Started stuff with Embiid late in the game, but finished with, looked like, he had 13 points. He had a couple of big shots, 3 of 6 from 3. And then in his first game against the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Clippers just ran him out of the gym. It was 133-92. I think I saw it was the Cavaliers' worst home loss ever. Which,
interesting.
Yeah, something along those lines. And Kawhi didn't even play that game. So what do you think of the early returns from Marcus Morris in L.A.?
You know, I think they're really trying to integrate him. Mm-hmm. And I think they're doing so because they know that both Kawhi and Paul George are probably not going to play every single game moving forward.
Sure.
So they want him to get as acclimated to the offense as possible. And with him being the shooter that he is, or at least that he demonstrated in Houston, or Houston, wow, New York. He did play in Houston once.
Yeah.
And in Boston last year.
Yep.
I think they really want to tap into that. So far, he's just, he's looked like he's basically playing outside the offense a little bit,
mm-hmm.
because that's what you usually do when you come into a new team and you're still trying to figure out the plays and your teammates, like how they move and identifying patterns and all that. So right now he's just finding his spots and he's shooting, which I think is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a potential there basically in terms of moving him up as the four.
Mm-hmm.
Kawhi, I know that, he can play the four as well. I really look at Kawhi as one of the few last traditional threes.
Mm.
So I like when you have him at the three more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's going to split a lot of minutes with Paul George at the four, which I like.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I'm... Are you higher on the Clippers now than you were heading into the trade deadline?
Slightly, but I'm also concerned because you know me, I'm not necessarily a Marcus Morris fan.
Sure.
Like the Morai brothers are not exactly players I feel you can rely on a locker room / chemistry perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But as I think we also talked about at some point, like you also need a little bit of crazy if you want to win the championship. And You know, he fits that bill.
He certainly brings that.
Right. You could argue that you had enough crazy in Patrick Beverley, but...
Right. And Montrez.
And Montrez as well. Well, yeah. Hell, maybe you didn't need him.
Yeah, right. I mean... Right.
No.
Yeah.
It's just another stretch four slash, you know, pseudo three that you can just use. I think this was just a depth issue, and you had to get off of Mo Harkless's contract just to use it.
Right.
And get something good out of it. And you got it. Like, you got more offensive production. You probably downgraded slightly on the defensive end, but I think that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I am higher on the Clippers now, and I think the concerns you expressed are fair. I think you're right to say that he's, you know, still very much feeling out his place in the offense, and he took a couple shots that I'm sure he would love to have back last night. That said, I mean, just adding another dangerous scorer like this, you know, to a team that already had Kawhi, Paul George, Lou Williams, Montrez, it's like they can just come at you in waves now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're right that during the regular season especially, he's going to help them stay afloat in that battle for seeding whenever Kawhi and Paul George do sit out, because I agree they are not going to play every game the rest of the regular season. But, you know, then in the playoffs too, like, it's going to be really hard, even as rotations shorten, it's going to be hard for bench units to keep up with, you know, depending on whether Morris continues to start and moves to the bench. But, like, they have those four guys plus Morris plus Landry Shamet, who can just get hot at a moment's notice, plus a great defense. Like, I am terrified of the Clippers, last night's results notwithstanding. Like, they are... they were my pick to win the finals before the season starts. The Bucks, of course, have, you know, made me think twice about that. But man, it's going to be hard to pick against them in the West.
Can I just say something that I find interesting? We talk about Houston being, you know, on the cutting edge, doing something new that we haven't seen before. They've gotten all the press about the ingenuity.
Mm-hmm.
Have we ever seen a team, you know, basically actively assembling a rotation wherein you have 3 6th men? Because that's in... I understand that Morris is starting, but ultimately I have to assume that when everyone is healthy, well, maybe not, but it depends on how he integrates himself. Right. But I wouldn't be shocked, is my point, if he ends up coming off the bench.
Yeah.
In which case, you will have the new school... covered in terms of, like, positioning. You'll have a backup ball handler, Lou Williams. You'll have a backup wing, Morris, and you'll have a backup big in Harrell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think this is interesting. I think it's interesting that you run out a team where you effectively have, you know, 3 6th-man caliber players.
Yeah.
They've already run out with two, and now they're adding a third.
Right.
I think this is, like, light years ahead, and that's not making fun of that saying. Yeah, I think this is really, really progressive, and nobody is talking about it.
Yeah.
So maybe that means I should write an article about it for Forbes.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it's hard to find 3 20-point-per-game scorers at a reasonable price to come off the bench. I think that's probably why it hasn't happened before, or hasn't happened in recent memory at least. So... Yeah, I mean,
totally agree.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a testament to the Clippers front office, really, to be able to have assembled this team in such a way that they could bring in, you know, another 20-point threat in Marcus Morris. It's, as I said, they're terrifying. I'm glad, you know, if the Sixers make it that far, at least they don't have to face them to the finals.
Yeah, no, the Sixers not going to make it that far.
No, probably not. All right, let's go into Miami, because when the trade went down, we said, look, Iguodala is great, great defensive player, you know, is not going to give you a ton on offense. Keep an eye out for Jay Crowder. Iguodala, in his first two games with the Heat, has played 20 minutes. He has averaged 2 points a game on 66.7% shooting, but he's taken 3 shots in 2 games. Jay Crowder, meanwhile, has scored 39 points on 12 of 22 shooting, including 9 of 16 from three-point range.
Wow, I am so surprised that Jay Crowder is better.
it's I just wanted to pat us on the back for at least saying, like, don't forget, this wasn't just Andre Iguodala. Like, they also added other players who are good. And Jay Crowder.
We didn't need that pat on the back because that was, like, the people who were saying otherwise, that's the people who need to be jailed.
Well, I mean, did you see anyone in, you know, in the, like, trade grades or in the national media when they were, like, discussing this trade? I just didn't see much conversation about the other guys in the trade. No, it was like...
That was the point of mine as well on the last podcast. Yeah. Like, it was Iguodala. I mean, after the trade deadline, we had ESPN on for, like, at least a few hours, and it was Iggy. I was like, yeah, all right, you're just basically completely losing the biggest story here. But okay, mm-hmm. Fair enough. He's a name, the championship name. Okay. Jay Crowder is balling, man. Mm-hmm. Like, I know that he wasn't putting up great efficiency numbers in Memphis, but he was still crucial to the way that they played. Like, if you saw the games in Memphis,
yeah,
you saw how important he was. You saw how much he loved he was as well from his teammates. Yeah. Like, he was very, very well liked. And he would come up with these crazy-ass buckets late in the game. He even had a buzzer beater, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, season. I think so. That sounds right.
Yeah. Off a Morant pass, if I remember correctly. But, like, you know, he may have shot poorly, but he just understood time and score, which mm-hmm. is so important. And I understand that from a, you know, basketball IQ perspective, he's not prime Iggy in any way. But right. you know who's also not prime Iggy? Iggy.
Right, current Iggy.
Current Iggy is not prime Iggy. Yeah. I'm sure that the mind is still there. I'm sure the intelligence level is still there.
Oh, for sure.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But he's not going to be a guy who's, you know, going to come into a playoff series and, you know, say, well, we need a punch or a boost, so I'm going to average 18 over mm-hmm. the next 7 games. Like, he's not that guy. He's not going to be that guy ever again.
Yeah.
Jake Crowder, on the other hand,
mm-hmm.
he could be that guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's not to say Iggy can't ever score, like, 10 points in a single game. Like, at some point,
sure.
I'm sure he will hit more than 3 shots in 2 games, but yeah, I'm just glad to see that, you know, Crowder has justified the, oh hey, this guy is also, like, we should have taken note of him because he is also important and he's gonna play a big role for this Heat team. Like,
right.
he was a very valuable addition in this trade, and he makes them, I mean, I would say, you know, the second scariest team in the East, but Toronto is never going to lose a basketball game again. So, I guess
it doesn't seem like it, does it?
No, at this rate. But just
to wrap up real quick, or just so I don't forget it,
uh-huh.
what we're saying about Jay Crowder here, you know, you and I, we understand that he's not going to keep averaging basically 20-10 and shooting 56 from downtown.
Oh, of course,
like,
yeah.
This, the numbers right now are insanely good. But we're praising Crowder not for what he's done, but because we believe in the fit of the system. We're not yes. saying that what he contributes statistically right now is that's going to be the norm for him moving forward.
Right. Yeah. He is not going to continue average what, like, almost 20 points. Yeah. He's
19.5 points, 9.5 rebounds, 2.5 steals as well.
Yeah.
Hitting 4.5 threes a game. Like, I don't think that's sustainable, Brian.
Right. That is certainly coming down. But he was a good pickup and a good part of that. Like, I think of any team in the East that improved at the trade deadline, Miami improved the most. Now it's, I mean, the Bucks did nothing, the Raptors did nothing, the Pacers have been in free fall since Oladipo came back. You know, we'll see what happens with the Sixers and how they juggle their rotations. But, you know, adding both Crowder and Iguodala, like, the Heat are clearly much scarier now than they were prior to the deadline, and they were a good team prior to the deadline too.
Mm. And they don't have Waiters Island there anymore.
I know. RIP.
No, I mean, that's just great for them. It's a distraction that's gone.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I would say when you have a guy who has been suspended as many times as he has played games, it is probably good to escape from that. And something just to look, like, you know, far ahead beyond this season. Miami cleared a ton of cap space in that trade and now is projected to have $25 million or so this summer. That means, you know, the Hawks are still at $50 million. the Grizzlies spent all of their money in that Iguodala trade. Like New York, Charlotte, Detroit are the other teams projected to have space. Maybe Cleveland if Drummond walks. Miami is the one team in there that is really, I mean, a clear playoff caliber team. Atlanta can sell you on, like, hey, we got a bunch of young guys, we could be up and coming, whatever. But, like, is a 30-something-year-old going to sign there? Probably not. Miami could come out, you know, like, we talked about the possible Danilo Gallinari deal. Well, now they could just say, like, hey, maybe we didn't need to trade for Danilo Gallinari, because we can come out this summer and say, hey, we don't want to risk our cap space in case Giannis comes, but right, we'll give you a one-year $25 million deal.
Yeah. I mean, that is certainly plausible. Or, you know, maybe if they actually move some stuff around. I know that Kelly Olynyk is more than likely to pick up his $12.2 million option.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe if you attach a pick and you move him out of the way,
yeah,
and you clear up even more cap space. Look, this is not a prediction. I'm not going hot takey,
mm-hmm,
or anything on this. But let's say the Lakers completely crumple in the playoffs.
Ooh.
Let's say something really, really bad happens.
Yeah.
And Davis is like, you know what? I want to make sure that I'm in a place where I can win championships.
Mm-hmm.
What team right now could win or at least get me to the finals?
Yeah.
Where everything can happen. Anything can happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at Miami if they can clear the cap space.
For sure.
I'm not saying he will.
Right, of course.
I think the overwhelming odds, like, are him returning to LA on an insane contract. I mean, it's 99.999% sure, but look, I would at least poke around a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And
if something goes wrong.
And we're looking ahead to 2021, and, like, it could be a superstar studded free agent class. Giannis, LeBron, Kawhi, Paul George, if those guys opt out. But, like, what if Giannis signs a Supermax this summer? And all of a sudden, like, you know, the Lakers and Clippers meet in the Western Conference Finals, and the Lakers, or one of them goes on in the Finals and either wins or loses, who cares? But, like, both of those teams are clearly built for sustainable success. Maybe LeBron, Kawhi, Paul George don't opt out. And all of a sudden, you know, the star-studded class that everyone's been saving cap space for, there'll still be some good players there. Like, Gobert could be in there, Victor Oladipo could be in there, Drew Holiday could be in there. But it's not going to be like, oh, there are four top 10 players in this free agent class. So Miami, right, you know, looking ahead, like, if Giannis signs the Supermax, maybe Miami turns around this summer and says, like, oh, well, you know, that changes things. Like, we're, you know, we don't think we're going to get LeBron or Kawhi or Paul George. So maybe we do. Maybe we go after a Gallinari or a Fred VanVleet or a Montrezl Harrell or whoever. And maybe we give them, right, the multi-year deal that they want because no one else can.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. I it's just something to keep in the back of your minds about Miami. It's like they are the biggest wild card of free agency, and they could make, because otherwise free agency is projected to be pretty boring this year, both in terms of, I mean, very few teams have cap space and there are very few difference makers on the market.
Right.
Especially if a lot of these guys, DeMar DeRozan, Gordon Hayward, Andre Drummond, pick up their respective player options. Like, it could be very, very bad very quickly. So Miami will at least spice things up a little bit, which should be fun.
And Miami also needs to make sure that they don't get too patient, because
yeah,
in 2021, you know, Kendrick Nunn and Duncan Robinson are up for new deals.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that they're going to have very, very low cap holes, obviously, but eventually they're going to get paid.
Yeah. And
likely significantly and so.
Bam as well. He's eligible for an extension this summer, I would assume.
That is true.
I would assume they're not going to sign him to one so they can preserve his low cap hold for 2021. But yeah, like,
he's in his third year. I keep forgetting. I mm-hmm. always feel like he's in his second, but you're right. He's in his third year.
Yeah. So like their window to use this space slams shut in 2021, regardless of whether Giannis or whoever become free agents. So, and like, Jimmy Butler's not getting any younger. And if you think, you know, depending on how they fare in the playoffs this year, if you think a guy like Danilo Gallinari could have been the difference between you losing wherever you did and you winning a title, you know, unless you have very strong intel that Giannis is not signing a Supermax and is coming to Miami, do you gamble and hold off for one more year, knowing that Jimmy Butler's not getting any younger and knowing that, you know, all of these guys are getting new deals in 2021, and like, if you strike out, then that's it. Like, you just wasted your space.
Yeah, you need to be clever. You know, I mean, this is such a crucial period of time. You cannot mess this up.
Yeah.
Like, one major bad move, and that's all she wrote. Which is also why, like, Derek Jones Jr., like, I don't think that they're going to hang on to him after this year.
Yeah.
I think he's going to cost a little bit too much, and I don't think they want to sacrifice their cap flexibility on him. So, like, that's another guy who could enter the free agency market, which could make it interesting. I know that, you know, he's not necessarily a big stats guy, but with his age, athleticism, and like, he has become a, you know, considerably better player
for sure.
Like, someone could pick him up on cheap. Like, that's a guy, like, if you're a rebuilding team out there and you're looking for, you know, young players who might come somewhat cheaply, like, he's right there.
Yeah. Paging Atlanta right now.
Yep. Oh, he would be great there.
Yeah.
In like a backup 3-4 kind of role.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my.
I mean.
Oh, my.
Goran Dragic comes off their books, too. He's been very key to them as their backup point guard / six man. Like, there are some big changes coming in Miami this season and next. And I am, like, endlessly fascinated with, you know, as much as I'm intrigued by Houston's on-court potential, I am intrigued with the behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing of Pat Riley and co. over the next, you know, 18 months or so. Because, like, Miami could either build a super team or it could just kind of get stuck in, like, a 45-50 win ceiling.
Imagine if Goran sticks around for the minimum.
Or even, like, the mid-level.
Yeah, even so, yeah, just a not a crucial financial commitment.
Yeah, because
I've been saying this for a while. Some Europeans, they just think it differently when it comes to contracts. And, you know, some of them, when they enter a certain age, like, they just don't care whatsoever and would even, like, take just nothing. He's, like, 33. He's going to be 34 by the start of next season. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. And I think, I forget the exact amount, Albert Namad, who is a cap expert, specializes in the Heat, tweeted it out around the deadline. But they have some breathing room between, we could still offer Giannis a max in 2021 and our total amount of cap space. I think they have about, they're projected to have around $50 million, and like, Giannis's max would be 37 or something. So they still have, you know, $13 million or so in breathing room. Now, I don't know if that was taking into account Bird, the cap holds for Adebayo, Robinson, and Nunn. I'm planning on looking into all of this, you know, between now and July, because I think it's a story worth exploring. But yeah,
it's a team to watch for sure.
Yeah, like, without question. But in the meantime, go Jay Crowder. All right, let's go to Minnesota now, Mort. Because we've only seen one game so far of the Karl Anthony Towns, D'Angelo Russell duo. And I think it both validated what Minnesota hoped for and validated our concerns about specifically their defense. The Toronto Raptors.
Our friendship, man.
The Toronto Raptors faced them on Monday. They scored 137 points, despite being without Marc Gasol, Serge Ibaka, and Norman Powell. Serge Ibaka, who you just wrote a very good column about, by the way, on Forbes. It was their second highest scoring total of the season, trailing only the 140 points they put up against the Washington Wizards, who have one of the worst defenses in NBA history.
I have a rule of thumb. If you let Rondae Hollis-Jefferson score 21 points on you and do so on a true shooting percentage of 61.5, or sorry, 63.6.
Oh, God.
Then it's on you.
Yeah.
Like, that's not him just doing something. That's on you.
It's, I mean, look, if you're doing the glass half full version, they, you know, it's their first game together. They're going to obviously need time to figure things out.
Right.
D'Angelo did score 22 points, shot 4 or 5 from three. Towns started slow, but finished with 23, 10, and 7, 3 of 6 from 3. The two of them combined for 11 turnovers. They had 23 turnovers as a team. I mean, Toronto's playing terrific defense and just has, you know, Siakam and Anunoby especially can just destroy stuff. But even Lowry, too, is a bulldog. So, you know, it's a bad first matchup to go up against a team that's on, like, a 15-game win streak now. I mean... Right. You know, there's no shame in losing a road game by 11 to, you know, the Raptors team that's the second best team in the East right now. But I think so far, I mean, you know, it's only one game. Who knows? Maybe the Timberwolves actually play defense in the next game. But the concerns about those two guys pairing together are validated, at least in terms of defense.
I'm just curious because you said, you know, the first game, you don't have the chemistry and all that. That's fine. I absolutely agree that the chemistry is going to improve.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have the defensive know-how, like, is that going to improve?
I mean, that's, yeah. That's,
is
that's
D'Angelo the... Russell going to turn into Gary Payton overnight?
That's the question. That's what, I mean, we said it in our post-trade deadline episode. Like, that's what the Warriors are banking on not happening. Like, they're...
That's good banking.
Yeah. Perhaps.
That's good banking.
Yeah. I mean, they got an up-close-to-personal look for the first half of the season at D'Angelo Russell not caring on defense, and they said, you know what? Have fun with that, Timberwolves. We're just going to take your top three protected pick next year. Godspeed.
I mean, look, like I said on the last show as well, I love them offensively. I love the theoretical fit offensively, and as you said, like, we saw plenty of that against Toronto. Like, this can be a duo that averages on the good side of 25 each. Like, they can combine for 50 points a game, just the two of them.
Definitely.
And they can do so efficiently even. So offensively, I'm not even that concerned. Like, the 11 turnovers combined, like, screw that. That's an anomaly. I'm not going to look at that and go, oh, he's going to average, like, 5 or 6 turnovers per game. Like, no. I'm not concerned about the offense. This is about... you know, those two guys having to turn into quality defenders, or at the very least, just league average defenders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about how the Timberwolves could just basically package, you know, defenders around them, or just, you know, put every conceivable defender you can find on the open market around them, and then that's it. Like, 3-and-D guys all over the place. That's all well and good, but teams can target D'Angelo and Towns specifically in pick and rolls.
Mm-hmm.
And then what?
Right.
Like, then it doesn't matter if you have Jarrett Culver on the wing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, I mean, Josh Okogie or whoever.
Right. Like, you can try to switch everything, but when your rim protector also isn't a great defender, you know, you can try to switch everything to avoid one bad matchup, but when you have, you know, a D'Angelo and Towns in a pick and roll, as you said, like, that's two bad defenders. Dude,
right?
Doubly switch? I don't know if there's a good answer here.
Like, I don't even know how you switch. If you just make it a game plan to say, okay, whoever Towns is guarding or Russell is guarding, just you two run the pick and roll.
Right, exactly.
Then they two switch, and then that's no good. Like,
yeah, that's gonna lead a ton of, you know, defensive communication breakdowns for sure.
Right. This is where my biggest concern is. So you know that, you know, Towns and Russell are great friends. They want to play together. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
In a year, if both of them are pointing at each other because of defensive breakdowns,
mm-hmm.
how does that friendship look by then? And what I mean by that is, you know, where do you go from there if that relationship sours because both of them are just pointing at each other, going, well, you didn't rotate. Well, you allowed your man to go by. Like, there's going to be a lot of... you know, you need to do this. Well, you need to do that.
Yeah.
How is this going to look a year from now?
The Warriors are hoping very badly.
Yeah. And I think there is a world wherein it doesn't necessarily go all that badly because mm-hmm. they just, like I said, the power of friendship, and they don't care.
Yeah, right.
Like, they just adopt a philosophy that goes, you know what, screw defense.
Yeah.
We're going to try to, you know, go Rockets about it,
right?
And average 130 points a game. To be honest with you, that's probably the approach I would take if I was them.
Yeah.
Because there's no chance in hell that Towns and Russell are going to be like the new Garnett and Payton. Ooh. That's not going to happen. That's just it's done for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bet on offense. Bet on shooting. Like, you have two guys who could, you know, average 25 points and hit 4 threes a game. Go for it. Go all out. Take 55 threes a game.
That really might be their best play, at least until either Russell or Towns show any semblance of caring on defense.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Right.
That's not going to happen. Like, re-sign Malik Beasley. He can shoot. He can take 10 threes a game.
Yeah. I mean,
go all out.
Malik Beasley has been very good so far with them.
And I do believe you and I, we said as much.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I think he had 7 threes against the one game they played without Russell, that first game. They destroyed the Clippers by 27 points. Because, yeah, Malik Beasley hit 7 of 13 from deep. I mean, they just
shot. It took him one game. Andre Wiggins had one game of his career where he hit 7 threes.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. No way.
And Beasley hit it, like, on the first game.
No. Oh, no. Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, they shot, was it 26 of 44 from three-point range?
Yeah, it was incredible. I didn't even keep count. I was watching the game. I was just in awe. Like,
yeah.
Hernan Gomez looked good. They were using James Johnson as a pseudo-point guard, which I've always felt was one of the things that people just didn't get about him when he was at Wake Forest back in the day. And I, of course, know this because he was drafted by the Bulls, so I spent plenty of time researching him back then. You know, he was handling the ball so much. And in today's climate, lo and behold, what's pretty like significant in today's world? Like, you have big-ass wings who can handle the ball and initiate the offense. Like, and they allowed him to do so.
Yeah, I mean, kudos to you for highlighting Hernan Gomez as a potential impact piece for them, because he's not going to jump off the box score by any means, but he played very well, especially in that Clippers game. And yeah, I just looked up. So Andrew Wiggins did have 7 threes only one time in his career, but that just came on January 27th. So the onslaught is coming, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
My beachfront property on Wiggins Island, the value is only increasing.
Sure. All right. I mean, are you certain that the presence of Tom Thibodeau on Golden State is not going to completely just annihilate his psyche? Because I'm not.
I'm more concerned about Draymond Green just yelling at him nonstop, because it's definitely coming. But, I mean, so far in 2 games, he's shooting 54% overall, 45.5% from 3. It is a hilariously small sample size, only 11 shots, but you know, not the most discouraging start for I like the Warriors approach. I mean, Steve Kerr has come out and said, like, look, we're not asking Wiggins to be a superstar. Like, he had the expectations in Minnesota, number one pick, gonna be franchise cornerstone next to Karl Anthony Towns. Steve Kerr's like, look, man, we have Stephen Curry, we have Clay, we have Dre. Like, we don't need Wiggins to be a superstar. We needed a wing. It's hard to find wings in free agency, the draft, wherever. Like, positionally, it makes sense. Now we're just going to get him to defend his ass off. And, I mean, that's the $150 million question that Glenn Taylor failed to answer, is can you get this guy to care? But, and this year, probably not, just because, you know, the Warriors are going nowhere and it honestly behooves them to lose more. But when Steph is back next year, when Clay's back next year, when Draymond cares next year, I'm still a little bit higher on the steal for Golden State than I am Minnesota.
Be careful what you say there, Bri. Like, you just said it behooved them to lose. The NBA is doing everything it can to basically say, that's not a problem anymore.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
Right. That's true.
But let me tell you something. After the trade deadline, for teams that didn't do anything or teams that just stuck, I don't think I've ever seen more, you know, before, you know, Twitter people saying, oh, now we should just lose games on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the tanking element that the NBA thinks is gone Maybe it is for teams, but fans are sure as hell still on that wagon.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. Maybe the Warriors should be careful about losing because then they'll get a Colangelo forced upon them. I mean, I think, look, the lottery odds probably do make it a little less. They reduce the incentive to tank because we'll see what happens over the next couple of years. But, I mean, percentage-wise, it's not as much of a sure thing as it once was. But, you know, for a Warriors team that has just been ravaged by injuries, like, do not bring Klay Thompson back at any point this year. No, just don't do it. I mean, Steph sounds like he's going to come back in early March, possibly. And, you know, that could be valuable just to see how he meshes with Wiggins, give those guys a head start on developing chemistry. I understand the rationale there. And frankly, like, you're probably so far behind. I mean, you're five games behind the Timberwolves that you are pretty comfortably sitting in, you know, a top two, top three worst record.
Right.
And
also, the draft sucks.
Yeah.
Like, that too. You know what? I had a thought here today. I would not want to be the team sitting with the number one pick.
Interesting.
I would not be that team. If I win the lottery, I'm calling everybody to trade down.
Oh, no. Elton Brand.
Everybody.
Elton Brand's the first one getting that phone call.
Yep.
Oh, no.
I would do everything in my power to trade down to like 5, 6, maybe 7. I would basically try to trade down to Denny. You know, Denny Avdija.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the Israeli forward.
Uh-huh.
Like, if he goes 5 or 6, like, just trade down, gather assets. So if there's a team out there that does win number one and, like, actively wants it, good on you. Mm-hmm. That's fine. I have a feeling that there's going to be, like, 10 teams that's dreading number one because it can go so bad with that pick.
Yeah, is it because you don't see a huge difference between any guy at the top, so you'd rather trade, as you said, trade down, not only get assets, but those guys are locked into a cheaper contract too. Like the salary slot for number one is much higher than number 6 or 7.
Yeah, that's just an added bonus. You know, with the salaries. No, but there are a couple guys up front, but here's the thing, you just don't know necessarily what they are. Like, mm-hmm. James Wiseman is this, you know, big ass center who plays like an old school center. It just doesn't make sense in the new, you know, NBA,
sure,
to pick him that high. I understand that there is, like, intrigue about someone who's 7'1" and physically is very, very overpowering and dominant.
Mm-hmm.
But unless he turns into Joel Embiid, and I have my doubts about that,
mm-hmm.
you know, no. Like, you have Anthony Edwards, very, very intriguing two guard, who is built somewhat similar, even stronger than Dwayne Wade, with similar athleticism, where you just go, oh, that's, like, how can this dude fail? Well, I mean, he can, because offensively, he just doesn't have a great nose for scoring. Like, he's improving on a game-to-game basis, but it's not super encouraging yet. I mean, there's still some bit of season left, and if I did have the number one pick, that's who I would go with.
Okay.
Edwards.
Yeah.
And then I would say, you know what, maybe there are players been in the draft, but I know that I'm going to get something out of this guy.
Yeah.
Then you have the wild cards, right? Like LaMelo Ball.
Right.
Like you just don't know. You know, Tyrese Halliburton from Iowa State, I really like his game, and he's very well-rounded, but that jump shot looks so weird, and it's not in the, well, aesthetic doesn't matter. Like, his release point is so low, I just have this, like, I'm getting some sort of Lonzo flashbacks.
Oh, boy. Well, Lonzo's turned into a good shooter this year.
He has, but it took a couple years, and he's never going to be this, you know, superstar player. And I just think that there's a ceiling on Halliburton.
Yeah, okay.
And then you just have a lot of guys where you just, like, Cole Anthony was one of the guys, you know, from North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And people were like, oh, he is so good. I was in on the hype initially as well because, you know, this dude can create his own jump shot, and UNC's lack of spacing is not helping by any stretch.
Yeah.
But even so, he's shooting 34.8% from the field for the year.
Yeah, I watched that UNC-Duke game with a Duke fan friend the other day, and he was like, so, he didn't even care because UNC is so bad, so when they were losing most of the game, he's like, whatever, this is their Super Bowl. But then watching UNC throw that game away, man, oh my God, they are terrible.
They are really bad.
That Playtech kid, I'm going to guess he is not on the draft radar.
No.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's interesting, though. I mean, I think there is a world where Cole Anthony can become really, really good.
Yeah.
But you just don't know. And you're just... There are so many guys here where it ultimately becomes like a gut check thing.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I mean, if I would, if I had a pick, like, in the 7 or 8 range, or, you know, 7 to 10, really, and if, you know, Anthony Edwards and Danny was off the board, I would probably go Killian Hayes out of France.
Oh, yeah.
Who plays in Germany. Long story. But no, this draft is so weird, man. So weird. So yeah, no, if I'm a team out there, I wouldn't necessarily want the number one pick. I would consider it huge, immense pressure. So that's why I hope the Bulls get it, because they could mess that thing up so quickly.
Yeah.
And that would be hilarious, and maybe that would be the nail in the coffin.
Oh, yeah. I was about to say we'll oblige you with more draft talk once the, you know, we usually do the March Madness prospects to watch, but, like, this year aren't all of the top 10 picks basically not playing?
It's very close to, like, Wiseman is no longer affiliated with Memphis because... Right. The NCAA is racist and sucks.
Sure.
Anthony Edwards, I'm not even sure about George's positioning at this point. I don't think they're a winning team. I actually don't know. To be perfectly honest, whenever I watch Georgia, I've just never paid attention to the score.
Okay.
That sounds completely insane, but I just never, like, I look at Edwards.
Yeah.
Completely.
Well, I know UNC is not going to the tournament.
Right. That's just so bad.
And then, like, LaMelo... international prospect, Killian Hayes, international prospect, like,
yeah,
a couple,
yeah,
of guys
coming in, and Danny,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah,
like, yeah, Danny Abdua, I mean, let me tell you, that is gonna be my guy this year, you know. Okay. I always have a guy.
Yep. I've seen, yep, his name bandied around on draft, yep, Twitter, so it seems like you've got some company there.
Let me tell you something about this kid. You know who he goes up against in practice? And I know this guy is 37 years old, but it's still Amari Stoudemire.
Okay. Yeah, that's something.
And Stoudemire is praising his ass off.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And he's also playing, like, against Tyler Dorsey in practice.
Oh, there you go.
Who's also, yeah, so there's something there. But, yeah, let's dig into the draft on another date. Like, this was a trade deadline piece.
Yeah. Well, for the three NBA prospects playing in March Madness, we promise we will have a 10-minute episode the week the bracket comes out at some point.
And in the meantime, I'm going to learn how to pronounce, you know, the center from USC's name. Whenever I hear it, I try to mimic it.
Okay.
I just can't. I'm so sorry. I'm really trying. I am so horrible with names that have African origins.
Oh.
For some reason, I can't effing pronounce it. And I always butcher it, so I didn't want to say it out loud.
Gotcha. All right. Well, luckily, I have not followed the draft at all this year, so I don't even know who you're talking about yet. But I'll get there. Well, that's a good place to wrap up, Mort. So thank you all for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes or wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and are now being hosted on Spreaker. So check them out on Twitter. At Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Power of friendship.